All right, picture this. You walk into a courtroom, and the outcome of your case basically hinges on whether you're in a state court or a federal court.
Yeah, you'd think the law is the law, right?
Exactly. Talk about unfair. But get this, deep dives we're doing, we're going to tackle a landmark Supreme Court case, Fidelity Union Trust Cars v. Field, a 1940 case that aimed to squash that very kind of inconsistency.
Oh, yeah, this is a big one. It's a major case for understanding how federal courts are supposed to handle state law, especially those tricky diversity jurisdiction situations. You know, when you've got parties from different states.
Different states, different laws, whole different ball game.
It really is. And this case, it's practically the poster child for the Erie Doctrine. And for anyone listening who might not be familiar, that doctrine is all about making sure people can't just pick their court, what we lawyers call forum shopping, just to try to get a ruling that's more favorable to them, you know, exploiting those differences in how state laws are interpreted.
Right, because that just wouldn't be cricket.
Not at all.
Okay, so let's break this down. What was the nitty-gritty of this case, the actual dispute that landed it in the Supreme Court's lap?
Well, at the heart of it all was a humble savings account. Simple enough, right? But there's a twist. A woman named Edith M. Peck, she opened this account and she titled it In Trust for Ethel Adelaide Field. Seems pretty straightforward, maybe, but here's the catch. Ms. Peck, even with that in trust for language, she still kept a lot of control over the account.
Oh, I sense a legal battle brewing.
You got it. She could withdraw money whenever she wanted. She could even completely revoke the whole arrangement. And to top it off, there was no separate formal trust document laying out all the nitty-gritty details.
So basically, it was sort of a trust, but not really, like one of those handshake agreements, but with a bank account.
You could say that. It definitely wasn't your typical by-the-book trust agreement.
I bet that caused some headaches later on.
You bet it did. Fast forward to after Ms. Peck passed away. And naturally, Ethel Adelaide Field, the beneficiary named on that account, she expected to get the money right. But that's when the executor of Peck's estate stepped in and said, "Hold on a minute. Under New Jersey law, this whole informal setup doesn't actually meet the requirements for a legitimate trust or even a completed gift."
So that lack of formality really came back to bite, huh?
You said it. And, you know, for our listeners out there, especially those of you knee-deep in law school, this raises a really interesting question, right? Like, if someone designates funds in trust for you, but they still maintain complete control over that money, can you really say that's a valid trust in the eyes of the law? It really highlights how tricky some of these legal definitions can get.
It definitely throws a wrench into things.
Absolutely. So that's where our legal drama really gets going. The case first lands in the district court, and they sided with the estate. Basically, they agreed that based on New Jersey law, what Peck did just didn't tick all the boxes for a valid trust or a completed gift.
Case closed.
Yeah.
Well, in an ideal world, maybe, but I have a feeling Miss Field wasn't ready to give up just yet.
Oh, you know it. She wasn't going down without a fight. She appeals the decision, and this is where it gets interesting. The Third Circuit Court of Appeals, they actually overturned the district court's ruling. Now, their reasoning was based on a 1932 New Jersey statute that on the surface seemed to give a thumbs up to these so-called tentative trusts, also known as totten trusts. These are kind of like informal trust agreements set up with a savings account, where the person who puts the money in keeps control of it while they're alive, but then whatever's left in the account automatically goes to a named beneficiary when they die.
Okay, so these tentative trusts, they kind of sound like they were created for situations exactly like this.
Right. And the Third Circuit, they saw this 1932 New Jersey law as the deciding factor, ruling in favor of Field. But here's where things get even more fascinating, and we start to see how this case really delves into the whole relationship between state and federal courts. So get this. The Supreme Court decides they're going to take this case on and review what the Third Circuit decided. And this is where the stakes get higher, because now it's not just about this one savings account anymore. It's about a much bigger question of how federal courts should interpret state law, period.
This is where the legal eagles really start to circle. So what exactly was the core issue, the big legal puzzle that the Supreme Court was trying to solve?
The million-dollar question was this. In diversity cases, when a federal court needs to figure out what the state law says, but the highest court in that state hasn't given a clear ruling on the specific issue at hand, does that federal court absolutely have to follow the decisions made by the state's intermediate appellate courts?
Oh, that's a good one. So it's all about which court's interpretation of the state law should hold more weight in a federal court, when the top dogs of the state's judicial system haven't specifically addressed it.
You hit the nail on the head.
Mm-hmm.
And to really grasp what makes this question so important, we had to take a quick detour back to the Erie Doctrine. As we mentioned earlier, this doctrine, which came out of the Case Erie Railroad v. Tompkins, it basically orders federal courts, when they're dealing with diversity cases, to use the substantive law of the state where the case started. The whole point of this is to prevent a situation where the outcome of a lawsuit comes down to whether it's being heard in state or federal court.
Which brings us back to avoiding that forum shopping we talked about earlier.
Right. You don't want someone to be able to game the system by choosing their court just to join and get a different interpretation of the law.
Gotcha. So in this case, the Supreme Court steps in to try and clear up this whole messy situation with the state and federal courts disagreeing over New Jersey law. What was their final verdict and what logic did they use to get there?
In the end, the Supreme Court decided to reverse what the Third Circuit decided and go back to the district court's original ruling, finding that there was no valid trust. And their reasoning, it all came down to this idea of respecting the authority of state courts. In fact, Chief Justice Hughes, in the majority opinion, put it very eloquently. He said, "It is inadmissible that there should be one rule of state law for litigants in the state courts and another rule for litigants in federal courts." This statement really highlights how important consistency is in the legal system.
That quote really sums it up, doesn't it? Makes perfect sense. Everyone playing by the same rules.
Absolutely. The court's opinion went on to say that these intermediate state courts, like the New Jersey Chancery Court in this case, they're not just some random cog in the wheel. They are key organs of the state, and because of that, their ruling should be binding for federal courts when they're operating under diversity jurisdiction. The only exception would be if there's strong, solid evidence showing that the highest court in the state, which back then in New Jersey was the Court of Errors and Appeals, would have ruled differently.
So if I'm following correctly, the Third Circuit basically ignored those earlier rulings from the New Jersey Chancery Court, the cases like Satcher v. Trenton Trust Co. and Travers v. Reed.
That's exactly it. Those Chancery Court cases, they had looked at these tentative trusts before under that same 1932 New Jersey statute, and their conclusion was that those trusts were not valid. But the Third Circuit, they basically said, nah, we don't agree with how the Chancery Court reasoned things out. And they went ahead and interpreted that statute differently. And the Supreme Court was like, nope, that's not how this works.
So what the Supreme Court was saying is that the federal courts should have respected what the New Jersey Chancery Court had already established, those previous rulings about tentative trusts. Even though New Jersey's top court hadn't directly tackled those specific cases, those Chancery Court decisions were still the best indicator of what New Jersey state law actually said on that issue.
Bingo. The Supreme Court's main concern was making sure state law was applied consistently. If federal courts were allowed to just brush off rulings from state intermediate appellate courts whenever they felt like it, things would get chaotic fast.
Yeah.
You could end up with a scenario where the law that applies to a case hinges entirely on whether it's filed in state or federal court, even when the central legal question is all about state law. And that would completely undermine the whole purpose of the Erie Doctrine.
Yeah, that would just create a legal loophole the size of Texas.
No kidding.
Okay, so let's bring this home for our listeners. For those of you out there studying law especially, what's the big takeaway? Why should we still care about this case from 1940?
This case, it's like a roadmap for understanding how state court decisions fit into the federal court system, especially in those diversity jurisdiction cases. When you're digging into state law for a case in federal court, you can't just stop your research at the state's highest court. Fidelity Union Trust makes it crystal clear. Decisions from those intermediate appellate courts matter a lot, and federal courts got to give them serious weight. Think of it like this. Those intermediate courts, they're the voice of the state law, unless or until the state Supreme Court steps in and says otherwise.
So even though the New Jersey Supreme Court hadn't issued a specific ruling on tentative trusts, those Chancery Court decisions were like the next best thing, and the federal courts had to respect them.
You got it. If you look at how the New Jersey court system was set up back then, you had the trial courts at the bottom, then the Chancery Court is that middle-level appellate court specializing in cases about fairness and equitable remedies, and then at the top you had the Court of Errors and Appeals as the highest court in the state. And the Supreme Court, they recognized that the Chancery Court was a major player in interpreting New Jersey law. Its decisions weren't something a federal court could just dismiss out of hand.
And this all ties back to preventing forum shopping, doesn't it? If federal courts were allowed to just turn a blind eye to state intermediate court rulings they didn't like, it'd be like opening the floodgates for litigants to try and get their cases heard in federal court just because they think they might get a more favorable spin on the state law there.
Exactly. The Erie Doctrine, which was reinforced by the decision in Fidelity Union Trust, it's all about making sure that the outcome of a case, when that outcome depends on state law, should be pretty much the same, regardless of whether that case ends up in state or federal court. This is all about fairness, making sure the system is consistent and doesn't favor one side over the other just because of where the lawsuit happens to land.
Makes perfect sense. So to wrap up our deep dive into Fidelity Union Trust Coa v. Field, what's the big principle we should all remember?
Here it is. When it comes to diversity cases, federal courts are generally bound to follow the rulings of state intermediate appellate courts on matters of state law. The only time they can deviate from that is if there's rock-solid evidence suggesting that the state's highest court would rule differently. Those intermediate court decisions, they're considered the authoritative take on state law unless the state Supreme Court says otherwise.
That's a great point. It's all about keeping the legal playing field level.
It really is.
And for our listeners, especially those of you who are future lawyers, think about how this ruling might impact your own legal thinking and research down the line. When you're dealing with a case in federal court that involves state law, how will this understanding of the interplay between federal and state court interpretations of state law shape your approach? It's definitely something worth pondering as you continue your legal studies.
It definitely is. Food for thought, for sure.
Yeah.
You got to think strategically in these situations.
Couldn't agree more. Well, on that note, we're going to wrap up this deep dive into Fidelity Union Trust Coast for Veald. As always, thanks for joining us, and we'll catch you in the next episode.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
It's been great having you. See you next time.
You too.